All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth State Podcast. I'm Jay Caruso, one of your hosts, along with my co-host, Mr. Ben Howe. How are you, sir?
Co-host and former roommate.
Former roommate, that's right. See, last week was after, so after we recorded last week, last Wednesday, Ben was on the road the next morning going to CPAC, and he was staying here at the Chateau Caruso. So Ben was our house guest for a few days. And I liken it to having, you know, being a parent to a teenager, you know, a teenager or, you know, it's somebody who's newly 21 and is kind of going out and having a good time, because Ben, we'd see Ben in the morning and then not again till the next morning, pretty much.
That's pretty, yeah, that was my routine.
Walking
I felt
in,
like a young man again.
Yeah, walking in, making noise, because of course, yeah, this is a one bedroom apartment, so that, you know, not only do we have to share the apartment, we have to share the bathroom with Ben as well, so... You know, there's all kinds of weird noises
so
coming out of 3 a.m.
You're welcome on listening to me pee in the middle of the night.
You know, the news gal, Andrea's here as well, right? Maybe not. Oh, wait, you know what? I'm not, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And one of the things that goes on behind the scenes is like me being an idiot, you know. So it's like I have to add her to the call to actually hear her. And so now, if you know, we bring her in and like add her to the Skype call, she'll be able to like say something, right, Andrea?
Yes.
So there we go. So there's the news gal. It's like I was like saying, I was like, hello, Andrew, are you here? And, you know, you were like, weren't saying anything. And I was the one like thinking, what's going on? And I realized you weren't on the call. So you're on the call.
I was texting you.
All right. So, all right. So before we get started, I just want to say, go, you know, if you like this podcast, go out to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a rating. The star rating, I don't know. People think Apple, and I've seen this happen in the past. You know, it's like they get, you know, Apple pushes up your ranking if they get like reviews that they like and everything like that. So, you know, leave us a good review. If you don't want to leave us a review, then don't. But don't leave us negative ones. We don't want to see that crap. All right. So CPAC, Ben. You know, you were there. You've probably been to a hell of a lot more than I have. I've been been to several. What did you think about it this year?
It was interesting. It was a different atmosphere, I think, than it's slowly been changing in atmosphere, which I guess maybe happens over time with any conference. But I've gone to 9 of them, or this was my 9th one, and you know, my first one was 2010, and it was very like most of my memory of it was Andrew Breitbart arguing with liberals, like in the bar area. Like that was 90% of CPAC to me. This felt like, you know, everybody was kind of together. I don't know how to explain what I mean by that. It just felt like, it was one big team, and it did not to me feel like that. Or if it did, it was a team I'm not on. I just didn't get the same energy, and I guess I didn't feel like there was as many people there.
Certainly that's the vibe that I got. I mean, I, you know, you judge it from certain things. It's like, I remember, you know, going when I was there 2016, 2017, you just go to have lunch, and any restaurant across the street from the Gaylord Hotel would just be packed with people. You know, you'd be even just for lunch, you might have to wait a little while. And it's like we were in the Rockin' Ranch. Andrew and I went and have lunch there, and it was like there were empty tables all over the place, and on the streets there just weren't like the, you know, I remember seeing the streets like teeming with people, crowds of people walking around. It just wasn't like that. I mean, it wasn't empty, but it was for them. They got a CPAC alert saying that the crowd was like a record size crowd. I'm like, what is this? Like a Trump record size crowd? It was,
yeah.
You know, I didn't get that. And you're right. I mean, I remember I wasn't there in 2010, but I was looking back at older CPACs, and like, you know, in 2010, like you're talking about, Arthur Brooks was speaking at CPAC. You know, and George W. Bush would speak at CPAC. I think even George Will spoke at CPAC at one time in the past. And it's gone from this, like you said, it was all one big team. I think you had different players with different kind of like viewpoints on certain issues, but everybody was like, it was about conservative ideas and advancing conservatism. And this was basically one big rally for Donald Trump.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is what it feels like. A lot of MAGA hats. And you know, I understand that in a lot of ways, if there's any place where it's appropriate to be like that, it might be a conference like this.
Right.
Because, you know, this is their team. But it's just, it's never felt, to me, it's never felt so plastic. Like, it just, it just didn't feel, the energy just felt like it was different to me. Now, I will say that my experiences are limited in one sense, which is my first CPAC was 2010 and Barack Obama was president. So I've only experienced two kinds of CPACs. From 2010 to 2016, it was all CPACs that were basically about our opposition to the controlling party. And since then, it's been the Trump party, you know?
Yeah,
so
pretty much.
I don't know. Maybe it was like that during the Bush years. You know, maybe it was like one big rally for whoever was the president. I don't know. I doubt it, kind of. But it could have been.
Well, it could have been. But I doubt that they were like booing John McCain at you know, and
John McCain's ghost.
His ghost in 2006 or 2007. Yeah, I thought that was a really like, you know, it's just like, you know, and you know, Michelle Malkin was the one that invoked John McCain's ghost and then went and said that Cindy McCain was triggered because she dared to like criticize it. And it's just kind of like, really? I mean, is this where we're at? You know, the guy is dead. It's like you're going to sit there and like throw shade
score
at him.
Points.
Yeah. Score points of because of, and you're blaming him and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell for the lack of like immigration reform. I know they're easy targets.
You know, somebody sent me something that Malkin had said and, you know, asked like what happened to her was kind of what this person was asking me. And I said, you know, I think a lot of the issues with people who feel a little blindsided in the Trump years is that there's how people act when they're trying to oppose something, like they're trying to lift up what they believe in opposition to something else. And then there's how people act when they're defending something. And so for most of the Obama years, which was like, you know, a serious time of activism and involvement for a lot of us, we were seeing how people are when they're trying to sort of pitch conservatism to a public that has voted for Barack Obama. And then since then, we've seen what they're like when they're defending something. And unfortunately, what they're defending is Donald Trump. So what you see instead is a lot of vitriol and rationalization and mental gymnastics. So that's my theory as to why I was so blindsided, is that I just had only seen everybody in one context before. And now I'm seeing them in another and finding out, oh, you're shitty.
It is pretty stunning to see that. So speaking of CPAC, so during CPAC, I mean, there's the usual litany of stuff that goes on. And, you know, it's unfortunate, I think, at times, because there was a panel that I was watching that had to do with Israel. And there was no like rah, rah, rah about Donald Trump. It was just basically talking about the relationship between Israel and the United States and how they're a big ally. There was, you know, obviously conservatives. So there's a pro-life panel. And this is where things got, you know, went off the rails a little bit, particularly on Twitter within the, you know, let's face it, this is an inside baseball thing. This is not, you know, anybody that who's casually interested in politics would even know about. But The Bulwark, which is the recent online publication, I think it started in December, that is edited by Charlie Sykes. And I think we talked about this a little bit a couple weeks ago when the article by McKay Coppins came out in The Atlantic, and basically talking about how this publication works and blah, 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 and whatever else. But in this particular case, they had two people that they sent there. One of them is a guy who did a lot of daily reporting at when they were at the Weekly Standard, Andrew Egger, who was there. But they also sent a, you know, not a conservative, not a moderate, not even a Democrat. They sent a far left liberal writer in Molly Youngfast. I don't know if you say Jong or Young, Molly Youngfast, to cover CPAC. Now, she wrote some pieces, and the pieces were kind of like in the vein of what she had been writing for them already. Basically, she was like writing stuff that was very mocking of like people like Tommy Lahren and Dr. Sebastian Gorka, which I you know, found relatively amusing. But they sent her to cover CPAC, and not only was she writing about it, but Charlie Sykes was like encouraging people to follow her Twitter feed. And so, you know, for people who don't know, there was one tweet that she sent out about a guy who she said looked like he was 400 years old, and it turns out that it was somebody with cancer. And you know, and then there was a pro-life panel, and she said, you know, this anti-choice panel or something is scary, something to that effect. And people were, you know, in my view, people were upset. Some people probably got too upset, and some people, I think their biases were confirmed. They already hated the Bulwark and didn't like the Weekly Standard, and so this just kind of like added fuel to the fire for them. But I also think that, you know, I think the Bulwark made a mistake sending her there. And I even wrote about this in my newsletter. You know, it's like, yeah, CPAC can be a joke. And, you know, when you have people like Sebastian Gorka and you have Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens and Diamond and Silk speaking at this kind of event, you can find almost anybody that can write humorous stuff about that from you know, and kind of make fun of it and joke about it. And I mean, we all know that, but they seem surprised to get a lot of blowback from sending a far left liberal there.
Yeah, well, I think I'm of two minds on this as well. Because on the one hand, this is the whole MAGA world, and especially the kinds of people who were super excited about every speaker at CPAC. These are the people who call everyone under the sun snowflakes, who go out of their way to troll people, who are awful to people, specifically to elicit a reaction from them, to have them be offended even by the 400-year-old man thing. Like, there's some people I can say have the credibility to yell at her about that, but there's a whole bunch of people who don't have the credibility to yell at her about that because they say awful shit all the time. But that's really, like, not mostly what I think is that it was a mistake. And I like Molly, and I know her. And she's definitely super progressive, super liberal. I think the issue was, it's making fun of the circus makes a lot of sense. And I think she could have written about it and she could have tweeted about it and it would have been fine. But it appears that they didn't give her any guidance.
Sorry. Fucking autoplay.
It seems like they didn't give her any guidance on, like, how she tweets about it. And, you know, we've both done things in the past where we were there on behalf of an organization or whatever. And they will say, you know, tweet about what's going on and hashtag stuff that's going on. But everything you tweet is going to also be representative of us because you're there for us. So I think that they should have probably done that. And I think the other issue is it's one thing to make fun of the circus. It's another thing to make fun of stuff that has nothing to do with the circus, like being pro-life.
Right.
Which is what I think a lot of people took the biggest issue with was, you know, she's not mocking Dr. Seb Gorka. She's not mocking Tommy Lahren. She was mocking a position that people across the spectrum of conservatives feel. And look, like I said, I do know her, and like I know she didn't mean harm in the sense that she was just trying to be snarky and funny. But she speaks the language of progressivism, and so those are the snarky, funny things to her. But they should have thought about that.
Yeah, and that's the thing I think. It's like, it's not so much she was even tweeting those things, but it's who she was there representing while she was doing that. And somebody who wrote very well about that, in fact, if you heard that noise just before, I was trying to open up and an article by Alexandra DeSanctis from National Review, who kind of wrote about it. And she, you know, and Alexandra was, she had tweeted about it and then got into a big back and forth with Tom, you know, Nichols, who doesn't even, you know, he doesn't even know Alexandra. And Tom is just, you know, Tom, I consider Tom a friend, but Tom just really can talk out of his ass a lot of times. You know, and this was one of those times where he's like, well, you know, if you're going to be at a, if you're going to be at an event that's, you know, part of a clown show, then I'm going to judge you based on that. And it's like, okay, well, you can, you want to talk about the person, go ahead. But this was the issue. And, you know, as far as, you know, as far as Tom is concerned, he doesn't have much, you know, interest in abortion, but, you know, there are a lot of people that do, and they don't look at, they're not radicals. Everybody's not sitting there, you know, holding up things of fetuses or anything like that. Like, you know, Andrea is a major pro-life advocate. And, you know, and we were kind of talking about this. We had dinner with Alexandra Friday night, and we you know, we were going through it and saying, you know, it's like, again, it's like what you just said, Ben. It's not so much even that she said it, but that she was there officially representing what a publication that bills themselves as a conservative publication. You know, their tagline is conservatism conserved. And I, you know, I just think, here's the thing. There are a couple of things, like Charlie, and I think Bill, they took the criticism a little bit too harshly, and they started using the reverse Trumpian language of, you know, stop being snowflakes and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And
right. Which I think is a very tempting avenue to take. I mean, and I get it.
With it's, some people, it's, yeah.
It's annoying when the Schlichters of this world sure. suddenly find their, you know, where's the diplomacy? Like, you know, they, it's annoying. But I also think while it can be fun to snark at that when you're just on Twitter and somebody says something that looks like they're offended and you think it's funny that they're offended and you're just on your own individually doing that, that's one thing.
Right.
But if you're running a website and you're trying to do some serious stuff, and you're you've upset a lot of the people who are potentially your readers, then you probably shouldn't do that.
All right, and it's like you don't have to be. I don't understand why there's this this kind of like there's this notion that says we have to be assholes too. So it's like when we were sitting in the media area, Laura Loomer, who was there at CPAC, had her camera person with her or something, and she found Oliver Darcy in the media area and just started like chasing him around the room and asking questions and, you know, saying, you know, and he was just like, well, I'm not going to talk to you right here. And he's like, well, you ask other people questions. She was just bugging him. And, you know, finally, I think security had to tell her, not that they kicked her out, but they said, you can't do that in here. If he's out on the floor, that's fine. But this is the media area. People are trying to work. You know, and I'm not a fan of some of the stuff that Oliver Darcy has done since he's been at CNN. You know, this whole kind of like writing stories about somebody who liked the tweet or something like that just seems a little bit ridiculous. But at the same time, it's like people were probably cheering this on. And I think it's like, you know, you don't have to do that. You can make your point without getting in someone's face, without being a douche about it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I don't know that many of the people on the right these days can do things without being a douche about it. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. Well, everybody's like owning everyone else. It's all about owning. It's just a, yeah, owning the libs. I mean, it was a Dan Bongino said, that's my goal. My goal is to own the libs. Maybe your goal should be to run better elections, Dan. Maybe you'd win one.
Thing is, I with all of these things, I always get it. Like, I get it. They were tired of being treated a certain way during the Obama years. They're tired of being called racist. They're tired of political correctness. Like, they're tired of all those things. And they're also tired of trying to be better than it. So the solution is to cram it down the throats of the people who did it to us. And I get why that feels good. I just think it happens to be part of, it's like bloodlust. They started doing it. Now they forgot that they started doing it out of a sense of or a need for justice. And now they're just doing it because they became exactly what it was that they hated.
Yeah, and the best part is that they sit there and they don't care. You know, Kurt will often sit there and say, "I don't care, I don't care." You know, I'd rather not do this, but I don't care. You know, unfortunately, I still think, you know, we can talk about this. That's doing long term damage. But there's another side to that. There's another side to that really just kind of annoys me. And you and I kind of discussed this a little bit when you were here. you know, as annoying as the pro-Trump right is, the ones that will sit there and just go along with anything that he does, there is also a, and I'm writing about this, but I want to discuss it with you, there's also an element on the right, you know, within the Republican circles, and I'm not even talking about the Max Boots or anything, or the Jennifer, you know, the Jen Rubens, who have basically kind of flipped into and turned into, you know, Democrats, essentially. We're talking about people that still, you know, still vote Republican, still stay their conservatives, this and that. But they are also, like, just kind of crazy in the sense that you are not allowed in any way, shape, or form to like, offer, you know, up a, I don't know, if you want to say defense of Donald Trump, or if you want to say something like, you know, hey, I think what he did here was pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not allowed. So, like, Philip Klein, a colleague of mine, he tweeted out something. He was, I think it was Tom Nichols, who was talking about, he was on Morning Joe, and he said, this is what he said. He said, quote, there is no policy that I want enough to trade off the norms we are destroying daily in the Trump administration. There is no judge, there is no policy, there is no tax cut. Nothing to me personally is worth what we're paying for. All right, so Philip Klein kind of got in on that and quote tweeted Tom and said, you know, he said, this is not a live question. So the worth it thing, he says, is not a live question. He goes, Trump is the president. The norm destruction is a given. And it's true. We know that. He's doing that. So the relevant question is whether we want the judges he's going to be appointing, regardless, to be good. You know, do we sit there and take what we can get while he's there, or we just, you know, or not, you know? And then he goes on to say, he said, saying A, that Trump violates norms, and B, he has appointed generally good judges, isn't the same as saying electing him was worth it, which is right. Which is a different question, already decided 2 years ago, but will be decided again in 20 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, some people, like Ben Shapiro, has said that in terms of the norms, or in the phrase he uses is the social fabric. He says that he didn't want to, he was never Trump, basically, because he thought a Trump presidency would tear the social fabric. And now, as far as I know, he's saying he can vote for him in 2020 because the social fabric has already been torn, which I find amusing, kind of, because, you know, if that's all it took, you know, one presidency, yeah, one election,
2 years,
you know, all right. Yeah, the social and moral fabric of our country, we've been working on keeping it together for hundreds of years, but then Donald Trump won the presidency, and so that's it. Screw it. Let's just vote for whoever and turn the whole nation into a casino. Like, it seems like a bit much. But I think that part of what he's saying is right, which is the same thing that Klein is saying. You don't throw the bad out. You don't throw the bad out as though embracing, or excuse me, you don't throw the good out as though embracing the things that are good automatically means that you're contributing to the tearing down of those norms. Like, that's not what's happening. If I was glad Gorsuch was put on the bench, and I was glad Kavanaugh was put on the bench, that doesn't mean that I'm going to vote for Trump in 2020. There is no getting rid of him as president right now. I don't believe he'll be impeached. I don't believe any of that stuff. He is the president. There's nothing we can do about that. We don't need to be against things that are good as though that's somehow an endorsement of his tearing down of our norms.
Right. And so just to kind of show you the reaction that Klein got, there's this Twitter user name is Jennifer Harris. And I know her from, like, Twitter and stuff like that. I also noticed she's a GOP communications person. And she replied to him, you know, quoting his part where he said the norm destruction is given. And she said, seriously, have you no principles or soul? And that began this long back and forth between me, her, and several other people where, you know, basically they were saying, well, you're excusing what he's doing. And just so long as other stuff happens, that's good. And I said, no, it's the reverse. It's not like, well, he's horrible in this, but as long as he does this, then I'm fine. No, it's he's horrible and he's doing this, but at the same time he's going to do this, I'm not going to sit there and say, well, I oppose the nomination of Neil Gorsuch because Trump is a bad person.
Well, just take this to its logical conclusion. If our country was invaded, are they saying they would be against him directing the military to act because they don't want to embrace the breakdown of our norms? That's ridiculous. You're not, the president still has a freaking job, people. And if there's no way that Tom and all of them can defend their position if you take it to the absurd length like I just did, which, you know, that could happen. There's plenty of things. Give me some time and I can think of some less crazy ones. But there's plenty of parts of his job that I'm sure they all think are fine. It's the politicized ones that people have a problem with, the ones that get the most attention or the ones that have to do with Congress or whatever, which, again, I just think is dumb. We can't change the fact that he won the 2016 election.
Right.
And if he's going to be running again in 2020, that's fine. You can be against him and you can say that you can point out all the ways that he's destroyed our norms. And I agree. And you can say that there's a cost to his presidency that's going to go way beyond all of this. And I agree.
Me too.
But I'm not going to oppose things that I think are good just because of that. That's nuts.
Right. And the thing about the Supreme Court where I sit there, and I'm not saying it's like, again, it's like Philip Klein said, it's kind of pointless to sit there and say it's not worth it. The decision has already been made. Catherine Miller from BuzzFeed wrote a great piece called The Trap of Turning This Election into the Final Battle of 2016. And she said, threaded through these debates is a nebulous sense that there's still a choice, as if it's December 2015 and there's a slipping chance for Trump to be rejected, but that's over.
Yeah.
And that's essentially it. That's why a lot of people, including me, including people like Jonah Goldberg, have said, you know, never Trump, essentially for the time being, ended when Trump won the election. Okay, he's the president. Yeah, I hate his trade policies. I think people were mad at me today because I was gloating a little bit over how he got played by North Korea. Because it's something he never should. These are talks he never should have entered into. It's not a matter of, well, yeah, it's great that he walked away without getting a deal. Well, it's one of those things where you went to the card table with your ass exposed already, and it was just like, you know, the fact that you walked away from a bad deal isn't something that you get commended for when you shouldn't have been there to begin with. That's the way I kind of look at it. So you and I could go on all day about the stuff that we don't like about Trump. And like you said, I have said he's going to do long-term damage to the party. He's going to do long-term damage to the conservative movement. This stuff is going to take a while, but he's going to go away eventually. Neil Gorsuch is going to be there for the next 20 or 30 years. He's going to right. Outlast Trump, and so will Kavanaugh.
And what Klein said is such a good point, which is the fact that I like some of these things that have happened. And let me be clear. I like some of these things that have happened, and I give Trump basically no credit for them.
Right.
I mean, there's almost nothing that he has done that I so-called support that I think if it hadn't been for Trump, it wouldn't have happened.
Right.
Like, I don't think that in any way. There could have been a freaking log, like a tree trunk, Republican, just whoever, just insert whoever, and they would have done the exact same things.
Right.
And in fact, probably a lot of better stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. The tax cut, you know, Paul Ryan basically was the one who engineered that and got it through. Every appointment, judicial appointment that Trump has made has seen the light of day because of Cocaine Mitch.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and I know Trump people, they have a big problem with me for this. The fact of the matter is, these things that I don't give him credit for, they only give him credit for that, but they don't love him for those things. They know that any Republican president would have nominated Gorsuch or Kavanaugh or passed the tax cuts or any of that. They know that.
Right.
They love Trump because of the stuff that I hate, the stuff that when he's calling the media the enemy of the people, when he's being a liar, when he's covered in scandal, when he's a vulgar, adulterous charlatan, like all of the crap I hate about him, That's what they love about him. That's the thing that separates him from other candidates or from other presidents. Not appointing a conservative Supreme Court justice. What fucking Republican president isn't going to do that? Stop acting like he's a hero because he did that. But what Klein said was important, which is, it's great that we got these things, but it doesn't mean it was worth it. And I think he's right.
Right. And then the question is going to come up again in 20 months. You know, OK, the last 4 years. Yeah, we've got Gorsuch. We got Kavanaugh. Now, for some people, that view has changed. Eric Erickson is one of them. He's going to support Donald Trump. He thinks what has happened is worth it. Personally, I don't. I'm not going to support. I'll announce right now. I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump. I just won't. It's the same thing as 2016. I won't vote for him. And if you want to sit there and say, well, that means you prefer the Democrat because it's a binary choice and you want to come into that stupid ass conversation again, go right ahead. I really don't care. You know, I'm the don't care factor for me has grown quite a bit in the last 2 years. It's kind of like how we've gotten used to Donald Trump's tweets used to evoke, you know, you could in 2017, if you were at Red State, Donald Trump tweeted in the morning, you could write a post about what he was tweeting and the traffic would go through. And now people are just like, yeah, that's stupid, but so what?
Yeah, that's our Trump.
Yeah, nobody. I mean, the Sunday shows used to fill half hours with them talking about his tweets. And now they're just like, yeah, Trump tweeted this morning. And it's more of them kind of laughing about it. More like, okay, this like this pathetic man-child is still doing this after several years.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff, like you said, that's the stuff that they love. That's the stuff that, you know, when he
that's absolutely what separates him.
When he calls him crying Chuck and he, you know.
Yes.
And he doesn't.
Yes. The worst parts of him are exactly what they love.
Yeah, exactly. So, we're just going to say, I mean, it's going to be funny. It's going to be interesting to see what happens because the Democratic primary is going to be an absolute shit show.
I can't wait.
It's going to be fun.
I'm dying for some fodder because, you know, so much of the news cycle is centered around Republicans and Trump these last couple of years.
Right.
It was like, you know, the Kavanaugh confirmation, that was like a nice break, too. I was like, oh, they're going to be crazy for a little bit. Okay. Now I can do this, you know. Well, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of crazy, it's kind of funny, and we'll just touch on this for a little bit. So Representative Ilhan Omar from Minnesota has been in Congress now for, you know, 3 months about, and apparently can't stop saying anti-Semitic things.
Right.
Like it's kind of like, you know, it's just like she opens her mouth and something anti-Semitic comes out. And each time she's had to like offer this, you know, kind of like half-assed apology for, I mean, she's got Democrats condemning her. I mean, publicly condemning her, saying you can't be saying.
It's creating factions in the Democrats.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. And so House Democrats were going to have this resolution where they were going to condemn anti-Semitism. Well, then the resolution said, well, it's also going to include language about, you know, hatred against Muslims. And then it got delayed again. And then now they're basically saying that that no date has been set for this thing. I mean, they were supposed to vote on it this week, and now there's no date. The language is going to be watered down. Omar is not even going to, her name is not even mentioned in the resolution. And Democrats have a problem.
Yeah. She's one of their new rock stars.
Right. But I mean, just talk about this. Andrea showed me a tweet this morning of someone calling Nancy Pelosi, you ready for this? A white supremacist.
So the snake is just eating itself.
It
was kind of inevitable, right? It was inevitable that eventually they would just turn the gun on themselves, you know?
Well, so Andrea Ocasio-Cortez and Talita, what is her name? So Omar, and then who's the other one, Andrea? One from Michigan?
Ilhan Omar, but who? No. Tlaib is from, yeah, Tlaib. And then there's, but you're saying Andrea Ocasio-Cortez, her name's Alexandria. Andrea.
Did I say Andrea?
And both, yeah, and both me and Alexandra DeSantis would like to make sure that her name is Alexandria. So you're, no, you're almost there, but she's not one of us.
I said Alexandra before. I didn't say Alexandria.
No. I'm just, but, oh, okay. But Alexandra constantly gets called Alexandria.
Yes. Okay. Rashida Tlaib is the other one. Is the member of House, the one who was like, we're going to impeach the mother effer, talking about Trump. She did the dual loyalty thing too. With respect to Israel. And I was listening to Ben, let me see what you think about this. Listening today to the commentary podcast, and Noah Rothman was talking about when Black Lives Matter was a thing and people were asked about it, a lot of them would sit there and say, well, all lives matter. And so the charge was, well, wait a minute, you know, by doing this all lives matter, you are diminishing the aggrieved party here in this respect, mm-hmm. by sitting there trying to both sides it, or, you know, to mm-hmm. kind of make it this universal thing. And I think that's what the Democrats are making the mistake here, is that, well, okay, anti-Semitism is bad, but, you know, we have this, you know, there's also this element of anti-Muslim.
Right. They're just whatabouting.
Right. It's whatabouting.
And that's like the infection of politics these days, is trying to share blame. You know, either trying to share blame by saying, okay, I was wrong, but so was everyone else. Or saying, okay, whether or not you think that was wrong, isn't this worse? You know, that's just the constant, because the problem is we're so connected now. We got 24/7 news. We got the internet. We're all on social media, hanging out together all the time. Like, everybody's talking all the time. Everybody knows too much of each other's shit. And so nobody's clean, nobody's innocent, everybody's made a mistake, everybody's tweeted something they shouldn't have. And so everybody's got something to point to, and they always do. Nobody likes actually just owning up to what they did. They have to find a way to make it seem like they aren't as bad because everyone else does it or whatever. And I guess that's what they're doing here. They're saying, okay, these are some remarks that aren't that great, but let's face it, there's other remarks that aren't great.
Yeah, there's other stuff that's bad.
She's Muslim, and I think that the idea is, let's not forget that she faces her own bigotry. Even as we're condemning her for this, let's not forget that she suffers from bigotry because of who she is their idea.
Right, and then because there was something that came out in the there was somebody who, in the West Virginia House or something like that, some person had a poster or something that linked her to 9/11. In some way, which is idiotic.
Look, there is Islamophobia. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. I've seen it.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't take long to go on Twitter and go to her Twitter feed and then look at replies. You're going to find some people saying some awful things that are clearly Islamophobic. That is going to happen.
Right.
But it has nothing to do with whether or not she said something anti-Semitic.
Exactly. And the fact of the matter is that she is a representative in Congress. You know, this is not some random Twitter user. And again, this whole idea that a lot of these people keep saying, a lot of Democrats keep saying, well, she's learning and, you know, and it's kind of new. And it's like, well, wait a minute. She's 37 years old. She's been living in this country for quite a while. She can't, I don't buy the whole, well, you know, it's kind of, you know, she's kind of new and, you know, so maybe she didn't know about this stuff. And yeah, I'm sorry. The whole, you know, Israel has hypnotized the world thing. She said that 7 years ago.
Right.
So she is well aware of these anti-Semitic tropes. The idea that she doesn't know about it is bullshit.
The other thing is, what's got to be uncomfortable for Democrats is that, and as you well know, the language she's using, a lot of people are saying, you know, because she's Muslim, there's people who are saying, you know, that this is how Muslim people think. But the truth is, this is how progressives that are pro-Palestine think and how they speak. And they have forever. They are extremely hateful of Israel. And that's been the underbelly of the left for as long as I've been in politics. You've seen the protesters. You've seen the signs they carry. They act like Israel is the Satan on earth. And it's all been very anti-Semitic for a very long time.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, this has just kind of brought it more to the forefront, because now it's not somebody with a protest sign, or it's not somebody just writing an article in a magazine somewhere.
Right,
they can't just
sweep it under the rug.
It's members of Congress, yeah. And, right. And not only that, she is a member of the Foreign Relations Committee.
Right.
So that there's a tad bit of irony there. So, all right. So, all right. So that's enough of
by
that.
By the way, yeah. You know, the idea that dog whistles suddenly don't exist also bugs me.
Oh, yeah.
Because we've been hearing about dog whistles for years. And then when she says something and it's in the context of other comments that she's also made, and then people are like, well, no, you're talking about lobbyists and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, okay, dog whistles don't exist anymore. Okay, thank God.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing was people were talking about, you know, Tom Steyer or Steer, I don't know how you say his last name, but I think it was Jim Jordan, Jacketless Jim Jordan, tweeted something where he put Steyer's last name and began the S. Instead of an S, he put a dollar sign in front of it. Now, Steyer, from what I understand, is not Jewish. Like, his father was Jewish and left, like, the Jewish faith or something like that. But he's not Jewish. He wasn't raised Jewish. He doesn't profess to be Jewish. But yet, that was an obvious dog whistle.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't about the fact that this guy is spending hundreds of millions of dollars of his fortune trying to get Donald Trump impeached.
Mm-hmm.
It was an anti-Semitic trope.
Where I will, let me throw a bone to the left here. It's got to be a bitter pill to swallow to see the right having a justifiable case saying that something is anti-Semitic, given what we've all been listening to the alt-right say for years now. It's got to suck. It's like, you kidding me? I've been getting memes from these guys in the alt-right that show me burning in an oven and calling me a dirty Jew. And now I'm the one who has to apologize for anti-Semitism. Like, I get how bitter of a pill that is to swallow, but you either do the right thing or you don't.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you either accept that something is bad and you say, I shouldn't have done it, and you deal with the fact that it's a bitter pill to swallow, or, you know, just be a hypocrite. And I guess they're choosing option B.
Yeah. Speaking of, I remember I got several of those. One of my favorites was the trail of $20 bills that led to an oven that people would tweet at me from time to time.
Oh, yeah. I got one. I put it on my Facebook. It was so great. They had taken the Jewish symbol and put it on my forehead and had written that I was a never-Trumper in the service of the Jewish, you know, cabal.
And I remember
they listed
that.
My offenses and everything. So, and there were plenty of ones that I got like that. I was told constantly that I was a never Trump cuck Jew.
Yeah.
You know, so given that that's the alt right, I get it. You know, if somebody that I considered a friend or an ally had said something that was anti-Semitic, and then all of a sudden people were asking me if I was going to condemn it, it would suck. It would be like, really? After all the crap I've gotten? Okay, fine. Like, I get it, but just freaking do the right thing or don't.
Yeah. Don't make excuses. Don't water stuff down. And, you know, let's face it. I'll be honest here. And this is just as a voting. This is just as a demographic kind of thing. Democrats often get, you know, a large percentage of the Jewish vote in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that hard, you know, that percentage that they don't get, they're not going to bring them back. Those are the very strong, you know, those are Jews who are very supportive of Israel, very supportive of you know, of politicians who support Israel, you know, but still you have a large Jewish population that going to vote Democrat. And I, you know, the Democrats are taking a risk on this to sit there and say, this is not going to harm us politically if we don't do this resolution explicitly condemning anti-Semitism. We can add this other stuff in and it won't be that bad. That's the way I look at it. It's just a political view. So, all right, Andrea, what's in the news? We got any good news?
All right. Well, the first thing is, this actually aired tonight. We saw a little bit of it this morning, but R. Kelly, who, you know, amongst all the Jussie Smollett issues over the last couple weeks, the thing that has kind of like been brushed a little bit under the rug and not talked about as much as, I mean, probably because R. Kelly's, you know, a good 15 years out from being really famous, at least in my opinion, in this white girl's opinion. But on CBS this morning with Gayle King, I mean, if you haven't seen the video of the interview, it was aired tonight, Wednesday, we're recording this Wednesday night, it was aired tonight, but he goes off in in the interview, and she is just Gayle King, who's, you know, famous for being Oprah's best friend, just kind of sits there while he's jumping up and yelling in her face. And so Gayle King said to in an interview that she, you know, people were saying like, wow, how was she, you know, so stoic in while he was, you know, jumping around and screaming and crying and stuff like that, and pointing fingers at the camera crew and stuff like that. She says, I was not scared. I never thought that he would hit me. After Oprah and my kids, Kirby and Will, called me to ask if I was okay because it looked scary, but I was never worried he was going to hurt me. I was more worried he would get up and leave. So what I was really thinking to myself was, I'm not done with this interview, so I'm going to let him have his moment. If I stood up even to comfort him, that could have been his invitation to say, this is over. So I didn't interrupt his anger and let him have that. If you see the interview, he is mostly screaming and crying about his kids. So I'm sure that, you know, I mean, you, R. Kelly's R. Kelly, but you have to imagine that if he's dealing with, you know, custody issues, which he has been, and also these, you know, assault and sexual assault and rape allegations, and not getting to see his kids because of them, you can imagine that it's a very, very emotional situation. But anyways, if you haven't seen the interview, you should go and look up the video. But yeah, this is, so what do you guys think about this whole thing of R. Kelly and then this interview and her just kind of like sitting there? And does it say something about women that we will just kind of like let guys kind of go off, or should she have been worried about herself? Or
Well, the first thing I would say is I
don't buy the idea that that he was emotional about his kids. I think this guy's a psychopath, and I think that he's having a psychotic break. That's all I can think. His life's over. He's clearly going to get in a lot of trouble. His career is never going to recover. I don't know how he's going to, I don't know what his life is going to look like, but it's not going to be great. And I think she just happened to catch him right at the moment where he was collapsing under the weight of it all.
Yeah, this is a situation where, you know, you have to like wonder who his defense attorney is, that you why would you allow him to do this? You know, there is this terrific video of these two lawyers who are basically giving this advice to potential clients. It's basically them the entire time saying, shut the F up.
Right. Like,
you know, if a cop pulls you over, what do you do? You shut the F up, you know, and then you ask, am I being detained? No. Then if they detain you, what do? You shut the F up, you know. That's this kind of thing. I, you know, Andrea, you're a fan of the what's the show with Adam Carolla and Mark Garagos?
Reasonable Doubt.
Podcast, so yeah. So Mark Garagos is, you know, if the name sounds familiar, you probably saw him on television a lot during the Clinton impeachment hearings and everything.
Also,
20 years ago.
Also the Michael Jackson stuff, which the Neverland thing aired the last couple nights.
Right. So Garagos is a defense attorney, and if he was R. Kelly's attorney, he probably would have said, no way you're doing this interview. No, forget it. Shut up. You know, that's the best advice I can give, because it's just people who are going to be part of a potential jury are going to see this. And I don't think it did anything. Like Ben said, I don't think it was anything favorable to him at all.
No.
At all.
No.
And, you know, Gayle King, you know, she composed herself. I'm sure she wasn't worried that she was going to get hit. You know, there's crew people all around. Everything is there. I mean, God forbid if he actually did strike her, that would just be the end of anything, any possibility that he would have any chance of doing anything. But now he's the interesting thing, though, is they got that one still shot of him with her sitting there and his hand up in the thing. And he's kind of like, and now people are already memeing it. You know,
oh,
R. Kelly,
yeah,
R. Kelly's a meme.
Yeah, She did say in the interview that she knew that she was never in danger. I did worry at some points that he might accidentally hit me because he was so angry that he was flailing, but I knew that I wasn't in any real danger. So that's what she said.
Okay. But I'm with Ben. I don't buy this guy's, you know, I don't buy his crap for 1 minute. I think he's basically, he knows he's screwed and he's just going to do whatever he can now to try and lessen the damage. Okay. So what else do we got?
I picked this one because it harkens back to, you know, some of the great 90s early 90s sitcoms that Mad About You has finally found a home, which is weird to me that they had to find a home for this show. Of course, you know, Hollywood doesn't seem to have any new ideas. So Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt are going to be reprising their roles in the show Mad About You. And it's going to be not on a regular station. It's actually going to be on, it's going to be a Spectrum original, which I think, Jay, if I recall correctly, like Spectrum is like a Texas, like kind of like Verizon Fios type thing.
Yeah, they're a division. So I don't know. I think they're a division of Time Warner, if I'm not mistaken. They're a cable company.
Yeah, so it's not going to be an NBC, ABC, CBS type show. It's going to be on, you know, specific to, you know, a carrier, which is interesting. But yeah, so part of me looks at this and says, so we really don't have like any new ideas. Like we can't come up with a new show. We're having to recycle more and more of the 80s and 90s because apparently we've run out of ideas.
Yeah, and I didn't think it was a good idea the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I watched the show from time to time, and it was relatively amusing, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't this kind of classic comedy. I don't know anybody that would be clamoring for the return. Oh my God, Mad About You was going to be back on the air. And what was this going to be, like 20 something years later? Were they going to be grandparents now? Are they going to?
Yeah, I just looked up a picture of them. They're not looking great.
They were the first show that really, like, you know, went all in with naming their kid on the show. Really, they named their daughter, and this has stuck with me. I didn't even have to look it up. It stuck with me this long. They named their daughter Mabel. So that was kind of like
Jay. We found the fan. She's right there.
My mom is a baby boomer. I think this is actually going to be really probably popular with the baby boomer crowd. You know, they can't get enough of their Nick at Night, and yeah, they want their
when you say
they're mad about you.
When you say your mother, do you mean you?
No. Well, what you know, what kills me though is like. You know, they named their daughter Mabel. So here is these two, like, you know, city kind of dwellers, white people. And they give their daughter the name of a character you'd find on What's Happening or something like that, or Good Times. Wasn't the mother's name Mabel on Good Times?
I have no idea.
I don't know, old person.
Hey, I mean, at least that's at least Good Times is kind of funny, you know, whatever. But I mean,
in the plethora of like 90s sitcoms, like Mad About You is behind Everybody Loves Raymond for me, and I did not. I mean, I think Everybody Loves Raymond is okay, but it's definitely like not like, you know, the one of the great shows, yeah. You know, and Mad About You is behind there. So yeah, I don't, and other than my mother's crowd, I'm not sure who wants this, but yeah, but they have a home now.
Yeah. Well, and the character's name on Good Times was Florida, not Maple. So I don't know where I got that. And I'm probably going to get ratioed now big time for my racism because I got, you know, the name of a character wrong on an all black show. Just, I don't know. I don't,
when it comes to these, like they did the same thing with Full House, and they have Fuller House.
Oh yeah,
on Netflix or wherever.
Who wanted to see that?
I don't think the show's done that well so far. But why? I'm not against reboots, and I'm not against sequels, and like I've never been as hard on all of those things as everyone else. But I do feel like it makes sense if it's a story that needs to be retold. Like, you know, if it's a story that's like, you know, when they rebooted Battlestar Galactica, it made sense to me. The special effects had changed over the decades. They could do something that looked a lot better. They had a new take on it. You know, that all made sense. There's plenty of movies from the 1940s and 50s that are in black and white. And the acting is a little different than it was these days, and they want to remake some of them. That makes sense. But when you're talking about a sitcom that that wasn't that memorable to begin with. Like, where is the, who's asking for this?
Yeah. I mean, you fall into a trap. If you can't like reboot a classic comedy. Like, you know,
because there's the chemistry of the characters.
Yeah, I mean, you can't Cheers. You can't redo Cheers. You can't redo Taxi or Seinfeld or any of those kinds of shows. You can't. You just can't do it again with different.
But the thing is, what they could do and have done is they take the basics of the formula and just create a new show.
Right.
I mean, like, they could do that. Why don't they just make a show about a couple living in the city?
Well, they do it. They do it with dramatic shows. I mean, there's Cops and Hospital shows been on for the last 30 years. You know,
right.
Basically,
nobody
they just
needs to reboot ER. Just
right.
Have a new show about a hospital.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
you know.
Jay, I know that we've talked about it. Like, a lot of some of the plots with modern technology, some of the plots of shows like Seinfeld, episodes of Seinfeld, would never happen today.
No, because I remember saying something. There was 60 or 65% of the plots of Seinfeld would ultimately fail if they had cell phones at the time. So
yeah, that's true.
You know, but I mean, like, you talk about a reboot. Speaking of which, you know, like, I was just watching the other day. I was watching Death Wish. Yeah, the one with Bruce Willis, which I actually thought was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't great, but it was pretty good. But the original one was made in 1974. That's something that was deserving of a reboot because of social media. You know, there was a funny part in there where the girl had filmed him doing his first thing, and the cop was like, you know, you have to make sure you can't do anything with this video. Don't go posting it online. And she's like, I uploaded that shit an hour ago. I'm getting hits like a mother. <You know>? And so it was a good line because it kind of fit into the whole. It was an updated story. You know, using today's technology, which I think was a good choice to do. But like you said, this is not something anybody is clamoring for. And they're not even rebooting it. They're just kind of like extending it out 25, 30 years or whatever it is. Like I said, I don't.
But there could, you know, like, sometimes these people may know more than we do, I guess. You know, I'm trying to think of an example, but I'm sure there's an example of some type of movie or show where you suddenly catch up. Well, like Blade Runner, they just did that, right?
Right.
This is the sequel took place 30 years after the original, and it was
right.
A pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Sometimes that works out.
Well, you look at the show, you look at the reboot of Roseanne before she torpedoed it. You know, that was actually doing pretty well in ratings and stuff like that. People actually, you know, post the 2016 election for whatever reason, like they saw this as, you know, the ratings were really well, you know, going well and stuff like that. So,
well,
I mean,
yeah.
People,
well,
sure, but on the flip side of that, there were I remember as a kid, they kept trying to do basically what they're doing here with Mad About You. There was a Gilligan's Island reunion. There was
right.
plenty of Brady Bunch reunions. And every time it was them trying to pilot it into a continuation series, like a new series. And I remember Return to Gilligan's Island, you know, and it didn't work. People were like, no, what we liked was the show we already watched.
Yeah. And here's the thing about the Roseanne show, which it was a different kind of comedy back in the 80s, because we were hit with a plethora of comedies where the fathers and the mothers were all successful. You know, they didn't have any of the kind of problems that you know, most kids had. And here was a family where the husband sometimes struggled with work, being unemployed, trying to find work. You know, they had kids who were screw ups. I mean, it was kind of like this closer thing to like real life, as opposed to, you know, let's face it, the Cosby Show. You know, you had the doctor and the lawyer, and every kid was like going to college, going, you know, I mean, nothing against
growing,
you know,
pains.
Growing pains, all of that stuff. There was none of that stuff that was like, people would watch it and say, well, this is funny, but this is like not representative of anything in middle America. And I think that's part of where the appeal with Roseanne. So when they brought it back, you know, they're kind of, it's amazing how, you know, we're now into this whole working white class kind of deal where they're, you know, that's like this focus of politics. And so it was a natural fit. I didn't watch any of the episodes. I didn't really care to, but I mean, I can understand the appeal. But Mad About You, I don't get it. I don't see it.
We've already spent more time talking about Mad About You than I've ever spent watching the show.
You're probably right. I think we've spent about 10 minutes, no, about 14 minutes talking about it. Probably the only thing that I remember from
You're
Mad About
welcome.
You.
You're welcome.
The only thing I remember about Mad About You is one time when she walked out and she had a toilet paper roll. And she had a roll of toilet paper, and she had the roll thing from the bathroom. And she's like, without saying a word to her husband, just like held one up, held the other one up, and then inserted the thing into the toilet paper roll and walked away. And that was probably just your typical kind of man thing that, you know, we yank a roll of toilet paper out of the thing and we just use it and throw it on the counter.
And then the laugh track kicked in, right?
The laugh track.
Yeah.
Anybody still use those?
Oh, they still use them, yeah.
Do they still use them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, all right. So that is the news. There we go. That's going to be your new bumper music for the news, Andrew. So now you guys can hear it since. Yeah, just so you know, and I'll tell the audience this so they can have a laugh at my expense. I reinstalled Skype. We use Skype to record the podcast. And tonight, Ben signed on, and I'm like, what is that hissing noise that I'm hearing? You got to fix something. He's doing all this kind of stuff and making all these adjustments and everything like that. And then at one point, he was talking about something, and I kind of like, you know, I can take my mic, and I can just, you know, I got a mixer here, and I can just didn't hear what I just said because I had taken it down to zero. But I did that, and I felt like the two-line phone episode of Seinfeld because I took the thing down. I said something to Andrew, and Ben's like, I can hear you.
Right. You were like, yeah, we're going to be doing that later. Like that. You just, I was like mid-sentence.
So he was like, you know, I can hear you. Well, it turns out that we recorded the podcast into Adobe Audition. But I didn't have Skype set to use my regular microphone. It was basically using the microphone on my laptop. And so that's the reason why there was this big hissing noise that I kept hearing, which I was insisting was Ben's mic, and it wasn't. And because I also did that, there were sound effects and stuff that I was playing throughout the time we were recording there. So I can't hear it. I can't hear it.
You were blaming me because you have Ben derangement syndrome.
Yes, I do. That is true. But anyway, it was all my fault. Because I was an idiot and didn't put the settings right in Skype, but we fixed that. So anyway. All right. Well, where can everyone find you, Ben?
You can find me at Ben Howe on Twitter and in the writing sphere. Look for me at Daily Beast.
The Daily Beast. And of course, you have your book coming out August. Is that right?
It's coming out in August. Just finished actually with the final edits today.
Okay. Can you pre-order it already?
What's that?
Can you pre-order it already?
You can pre-order it already. If you go to my Twitter account, the URL for the Amazon pre-order is in my bio.
Yeah, and do that. I mean, I was reading today. You guys both know Yasher. Is his last name Ali? I can't remember his last name.
Ali, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he was talking about how important it is for people to. That pre-orders for books are pretty important in terms of, you know, getting them up on lists and things of that nature. So if you're going to buy Ben's book, you know, pre-order it. Don't wait for it to come out. I could be a real cheapskate and just call the publisher and say, send me a review copy, but I'll probably go ahead and pre-order it anyway.
Yeah, you should go ahead and pre-order it.
So go ahead and do that. Andrea, where can everybody find you?
You can find me at Andrea and Ruth on Twitter. You can also find me editing the ARC Digital newsletter and also Jay's Monday Notice. So if you are not subscribed to Jay's Monday Notice email, it only comes once a week, but you should definitely be reading it because a lot of times he puts special heart into that because you're not doing it for money. And it's something that a lot of times you just you say the things that you really want to say because no one's paying you to do it. So.
Yeah, you see there. That's what $20 gets you, is a plug like that. You can also find Andrea and Kim Ross at their podcast called The Right Side. Look for that at therightside.us. And she is also an associate editor at ARC Digital, which I think is I have been reading a lot of their stuff, and I think they're just emerging. They're going to emerge as something that's pretty darn good. If you want kind of trying to think of where I would put them in the spectrum of similar, I would say in some respects to like the Atlantic in terms of the content that they're producing, and they've got some good stuff. I think Virad Mehta's piece on the Bulwark and the issues that they're having, I think was terrific. I think it was terrific. I think it was a fair critique. It wasn't nasty. It wasn't like, oh, they're a bunch of losers who can't, you know, it wasn't anything like that. It was just, I think, a fair critique about their mission. So they got good stuff going over there. So anyway, you can find me at Jay Caruso on Twitter. Also, I am, editing the Washington Examiner magazine. Hey, if you've got stuff that you want to write about for the magazine, you know, pitch me, Jay Caruso, the initial J, Caruso at WashingtonExaminer.com. Unlike some other places, we actually pay. So you can actually get some money if you write something good for us. So anyway, that's going to do it. We will check in next time with you here on the Fifth Estate. And so now everyone can hear the music as we roll out. We'll see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.